You have a Bible or a way to access your Bible, we're going to be in John chapter 3 this morning, John 3, and we're going to read verses 22 through 36 in just a moment. Today we're continuing our study through the Gospel of John, and we've kind of divided up into these themes. And today we're going to continue to talk about looking at the world through the eyes of God. Looking at the world through the eyes of God. You know, the man that we're going to read about in this story today, he does that. Not a lot of people do that. Most of us, by our very natures, we look at the world through our own lens, through what matters to us, what we're concerned about. But the man we're going to meet in this story today, it really is a person who was looking at the world through the eyes of God. And in this section, in this scene, in this story, which happens right after John 3:16, happens right after Jesus meets Nicodemus, in this section, a question will be answered. You might call it life's most important question. We'll read the answer here, but we'll discover that no one asks this question. John chapter 3, verse 22. After Jesus meets with Nicodemus, after it's explained that God so loved the world that he gave his only son, after that happens, when Jesus is in Jerusalem and all that happens, Jesus and his disciples went out into the Judean countryside. As I was reading that this week, I just kept thinking just a few days ago about being in Jerusalem and taking literally that drive from Jerusalem toward the Dead Sea, and you go down, and then the scenery changes from beautiful lush to this kind of arid desert, and there's no water anywhere. And so it's remarkable what actually happens here. It says, after this, Jesus and his disciples went into the Judean countryside where he spent some time with them and baptized. And you're like, where are they going to find water for this? And there's just a few places out there. But then all of a sudden in the story, the scene changes. We're not in the Judean countryside anymore. Look where we are, verse 23. Now, John, this is John the Baptist, also was baptizing. Now, that's kind of like, we expect that, right? We expect John to be baptized. We would kind of be surprised if John wasn't baptizing. He's John the Baptist. John was baptizing, but he wasn't baptizing in the same place. In fact, he wasn't even baptizing in the same place that he baptized Jesus. He was baptizing at Enon near Salem. We were just close to this a few days ago. We were at a place called Bet Shan, which is this huge, ancient ruin of a city. It's one of the largest archaeological places in Israel. And on the top of it is this mound of 20 different civilizations. And on the top of it, when we ran up to the top of it, you could see the Jordan River, the Jordan Valley, Jordan. And you could see all of these lush areas where there were springs and there were little pools and reservoirs and ancient communities that lived there. And one of those was this place called Enon. It's an old Semitic word meaning a spring. And so it was a place in the desert where there was water. And it was at a place near Salem, which is Shalom, the Hebrew word that means peace, because there was plenty of water there, and people were coming, and they were being baptized. And then the Bible tells us this was before John was put into prison, and every time I read that, I kind of laugh to myself a little bit, because I'm like, well, of course, how's he going to be baptizing people there if he's in prison? An argument develops. Somebody has said that this is the first argument among Baptists. It's a good joke, right? An argument developed between some of John's disciples and a certain Jew. It doesn't tell us who he was. Anonymous. Kind of interesting. Makes me wonder, who is this guy? A certain Jew. Over the matter of ceremonial washing. Now, what's that? That's not taking a bath because you stink, like we say to our kids. Ceremonial washing is this idea that in order to be near God or something of God, you have to go through some ritual in order to give the appearance that you're okay. And remember when Jesus did the miracle, he turned water into wine? The containers were ceremonial washing containers. because the Jews had all these ways to get ritually clean, and they had all these laws about it. And so there was an argument with somebody who was saying, look, this is the way you're supposed to do this ritual thing to be clean. John, what are you out here telling people they need to get baptized for? Like, what does that have anything to do with this? And so it's like this inter-religious argument taking place from a certain Jew. They came to John. Okay, so like the argument starts among the disciples, and then they go to John the Baptist. It's like, solve this for us. They came to John, and they said, Rabbi. So one time John the Baptist is ever called Rabbi. The word means something like great one. Rabbi, that man who was with you on the other side of the Jordan, that's where Jesus got baptized, on the other side, in another location. The one you testified, remember he said, look, the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world, that one, Jesus, that's what he's talking about. Look, he is baptizing, and everyone is going to him. You hear that? Like, Jesus' crowds are like huge, John. They're huge. Yeah, pun intended, right? But yours are getting smaller. Nobody's coming to see you anymore. How would you respond? Just that basic human instinct we all have in us, that competitiveness, like, we want to be better than? I mean, could you imagine John saying, I got to be better than Jesus? It sounds silly, doesn't it? But look how John does respond. To this, John replied, a person can receive only what is given them from heaven. What a great insight. You and I only have what God has given us. You yourselves can testify that I said, I am not the Messiah, but am sent ahead of him. The bride belongs to the bridegroom. That makes sense. The friend who attends the bridegroom waits and listens for him and is full of joy when he hears the bridegroom's voice. That joy is mine, and it is now complete. In other words, at a wedding, the bride and the groom get married. Not everyone else is standing around going, I wish I was getting married, although that sometimes happens, I'm sure. The point that he's making here, though, is that there's an intended purpose here. The joy of the friend is, I'm glad my friend is getting married. The joy is mine, and it's now complete, and then you hear it. One of the great texts of the Bible. One of the most famous verses in John. He says, he, speaking of Jesus, must become greater and I must become less. Those are humble words, aren't they? The one who comes from above, speaking about Jesus, is above all. The one who is from the earth belongs to the earth and speaks as one from the earth. The one who comes from heaven is above all. He's talking about Jesus. He testifies to what he's seen and heard, but no one accepts his testimony. Whoever has accepted it has certified that God is truthful. The word certified there is the signet ring that you press into hot wax to seal a document. It's signed and sealed, although not necessarily delivered. Whoever has accepted it has certified that God is truthful, for the one whom God has sent speaks the words of God. For God gives the Spirit without limit. That's never said of anyone else in the Bible. Only said of Jesus. The Father loves the Son and has placed everything in his hands. And then he says this, the answer to life's most important question. Whoever believes in the Son has eternal life, but whoever rejects the Son will not see life, for God's wrath remains on him. The answer to life's most important question could be a t-shirt. If you know Jesus, you know life. If you don't know Jesus, you don't know life. K-N-O-W Jesus, K-N-O-W life. N-O Jesus, N-O life. It's as simple as that. That's the answer, but the question is never asked. This is so fascinating. Here this certain Jew comes to John's disciples and John and starts this whole conversation, but he misses life's most important question. John responds by saying, I must become lesser, he must become greater. I'm just the friend at the wedding. I'm not the one getting married. My joy is complete that the wedding took place. This morning I turned on my phone and it said there was the Prince of England, Prince William, was involved in an almost accident. He joined the military, as you know, and he flies an ambulance helicopter for the military. This morning, a drone almost ran into him, or he into it. Prince William is in line to become the King of England if Prince Charles decides not to do it. Can you just imagine the day when Prince William becomes king? And all of his military buddies are sitting around the British pub, and they're watching the coronation on TV, and one of them says, "I should have been king." And somebody else says, "Yeah, well, you guys were all buddies together. You all served together in the military. Why didn't you become king? Aren't you a good soldier?" Someone would have to explain to him, wouldn't they? That's not how it works. Just because you're friends with somebody doesn't mean that you get to be that person that does that. No, you have to have like a royal bloodline, and you know, there's this whole family and this whole medieval royal history and kind of a whole bunch of stuff I got to explain to you, right? No, the person that gets to be the king is the person who's supposed to be the king. The person in the story who's going to rise to greatness and prominence is the person that God has chosen in the story. Jesus is the king. So what's going on with this certain Jew? It's an old problem called envy. I know none of you have anything to worry about with that today, so I know you'll just kind of tune me out for the rest of the sermon. But just in case you know somebody who does have a problem with envy, you might want to listen. Proverbs says that a heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones. Envy destroys life. At the end of the Gospel of John, there's a scene in John 20 when the disciples see Jesus alive, he's died, he's resurrected, they see him alive, and they're so excited. John 20:20, like 20/20 vision. The disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. That's what 20:20 says. But do you know what 21:21 says? That's when Jesus is talking to Peter on the shore of Galilee, and Jesus says, "Peter, you know, you're going to die. You're going to die on a cross." It's basically what he tells him. And Peter's like, "Me?" And he points to another man, John, the beloved disciple, and he says this, "But Lord, what about this man?" And Jesus is like, "I'm not talking to him. I'm talking to you." But that's what we do, isn't it? Is he going to have a better deal than me? What about this other person? Now, I know none of you deal with envy at all, and it's never been a problem in your life, so you can't relate it all to the story of a young Stanford student, but I certainly can, and I'm sure most of you probably can too. The young Stanford student decided to go study far in the Far East, somewhere in China or something, and he ran into a group of Buddhists. You know, these are kind of humble guys, right? And they started criticizing this man, and they started saying to him, "You know, you're so ambitious." And they told him, "You know, the only reason that you study so hard, it's not to learn, but to get a better grade than your friend. And the only reason that you work so hard is not to make society better. It's so you can purchase more than your peers. The only reason you date the most beautiful girls is not to find true love, but to be seen with the most admired women." And the young man admitted it. He said, "You're right." And he decided that he was going to drop out of school. He called his parents from Tokyo, Japan. Can you imagine the parents hearing this news? "I'm dropping out of Stanford, and I'm going to join a Buddhist monastery." I'm sure parents were delighted. 6 months later, parents get a letter from the son. "Dear Dad and Mom, I know you weren't happy with my decision to stay here, but I want to tell you how happy I am now. I'm at peace for the first time in my life, living in an environment without competition or envy. Here we all share life as equal, and the way of life is so much in harmony with the inner essence of my soul that in only 6 months, I've become the number two disciple in the monastery, and I think I can be number one by June." Problem of envy was eradicated, right? Just join the monastery. It's something that's inside of us. Who is this anonymous Jew? Who is this guy who, when life's most important question is answered, he doesn't ask it? It misses him. It's important because maybe here today, you're a person who, whether you realize it or not, you've not asked life's most important question, so you might want to know how you can miss it or how you cannot miss it. I'll tell you the three groups of people that will miss it that I think define this Jew. Number one, not the religious. Not the religious. The religious will not get this. The religious will not understand this. And by religious, I mean that in like quotes. Not people who have anything to do with religion, but the bad version of this religion. This Jew, this certain Jew, was having a theological argument about a ritual cleansing. And that was all that he cared about. And in the midst of that conversation, Jesus Christ was on earth performing baptisms, bringing the kingdom of God to this world, and he was worried about how he was following some tedious, minute religious ritual. And so not the religious. The religious are going to miss this. They're never going to ask the question. Now, I don't want to be so hard on them. There's some story behind this. You read the Old Testament and you read the story. God had called Abraham. He had sons. They went to live in Egypt in slavery, and he called them out by Moses. They went into the promised land. They built a kingdom. David ran it. Saul ran it. But then a few centuries later, the Babylonians came in and they destroyed it. 586 BC, the walls came down in Jerusalem. The king was taken away. It was gone. And the people, when they came back, they all said to themselves, never again. Never again do we want this to happen. After the what they call the Babylonian exile, the Jewish people sought to carefully follow the law to prevent further catastrophes. We do the same kind of thing in our own life. We try to follow a mistake, try to follow the rules so we don't make a mistake. They tried this so much, though, that by the time of Jesus, an unintended consequence took place. And I say it like this. This fastidious focus, this careful focus on the law, bred a sort of legalism. You know, legalism, it's when you care about the rules even though you don't even care about why the rules are there. Or they may not even be the real rules. You just made up new ones. The fastidious focus on the law bred a sort of legalism that led to hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is the word that means to wear a mask. In other words, like if you're trying to be a whole society that follows the law so that God doesn't let bad things happen to you, and then one day you find out you can't do that, you know what you're going to do? You're going to fake it. And that's what everybody was doing. And some of them were better at faking. Some were pretending that they were perfect. The word hypocrisy, the mask, was used in the Greek theater. You know, Jesus grew up in Nazareth, and we were there the other day, and we could see, and we actually went and visited a nearby hill, just on the other side of the valley, just a few miles away, the capital of Galilee called Sepphoris. And at Sepphoris, there were Greek theaters. Jesus probably saw Greek theater. He probably saw them wearing the masks in the theater. He saw people hiding and pretending to be something that they were not. And Jesus would use this again and again to criticize the religious legalists. Listen to Matthew 23. It's his long diatribe on this. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees, he said, sit in Moses' seat, so you must be careful to do everything they tell you to do, but do not do what they do. It's kind of like what we tell our kids, right? Or your parents told you, do what I say, not what I do. Do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. And then he goes on to say, everything they do is done for people to see. It's all about appearances. And then he goes on to say, woe to you teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites, you mask wearers. You shut the door of the kingdom of heaven in people's faces. You yourselves don't enter, nor do you let those who are trying to. And that describes the man in this story, this certain Jew. His religion was actually keeping people from coming to Jesus, or at least he was trying to. Not the religious. Number two, not the arrogant. And I get this one by just comparing John the Baptist. John was a humble guy. I mean, he was famous. He's written about in history. John 3:30, though, he says, I must become less. He must become greater. He must become greater. There is a humble man behind those words. But Jesus also warns about these people who are not. They're arrogant. He goes on to say in Matthew 23, they love the place of honor at banquets. Like, they're only being religious so they can, like, be honored for it. They love the important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and to be called Rabbi, the Great One. But Jesus says, you're not to be called a rabbi. You just have one teacher and you're all brothers. Don't call anyone on earth father, for you have one father and he's in heaven. Nor are you to be called instructors, because you just have one instructor, the Messiah. The greatest among you will be your servant. Jesus says that in Matthew 23, but he could have been talking about John the Baptist, right? For those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Think about it in real life, just everyday life today. You ever met a person with a lot of religious pride? Religious proud people, they talk about themselves and they elevate themselves, but they push people away. Really religiously proud people, nobody wants to be around. In fact, they may even wonder, like, why doesn't anybody want to be around me? I read the Bible 50,000 times a day and don't do anything, blah, blah, blah. Religiously prideful people, it's really all about them. Real religion, though, humbles self, and it attracts people to God. You know, when you're around somebody who's really humble, you love it, because they're not just talking about them, they're talking about you too. Humble people are attractive people, and they attract people to God. So I want to ask you a question today. Does your Christianity bring people in or keep people out? Does it bring people in or does it keep people out? Because the man in the story was trying to keep everyone out that didn't agree exactly with him about every little thing. Not the religious, not the arrogant, and certainly not the envious. This whole story is really about envy, isn't it? The whole moment when, look at how many people are following Jesus and getting baptized. Now, let's be honest, like, what's the big deal about it? I mean, isn't envy kind of like a good thing? Doesn't it motivate us? If we see somebody has something, we're like, we're going to try to go get that thing too. Isn't envy kind of good? I guess there could be some good ways to look at envy, but it's also something that can be very dangerous. J.I. Packer, who's a world-renowned writer and theologian, once said, described envy as the most cancerous and soul-destroying vices there is. But just think about it. Just 1 Corinthians 13, everyone knows the chapter on love. Love is patient. Oops, didn't do that one today. Anybody want to confess to that one? Yeah, it's kind of a tough one. It's right out of the box, especially with parents, right? And kids, and adults, and everyone on earth. Love is kind. Well, not, sometimes it doesn't feel like that, but that makes sense. What's the next line? It does not envy. You think about it. If you can't have envy for somebody you really love. My kids do well in soccer. I'm not like sitting on the sidelines going, I can do better than you. I wish I was out there. I'm just proud for them, you know? You love somebody. You want to see them succeed. You're excited about what they're doing. You're in it with them. You're for them. Envy, just it does the opposite. It tears people down. We all know John 3:16, but here's James 3:16. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. That's a lot of practices. That's a lot of evil. There's a lot of every in that sentence. Every evil practice is somehow connected to envy. It can be dangerous. In fact, when the medieval guys were writing out what are the worst sins, which, by the way, are not in the Bible, it's just their version of these, what we call the seven deadly sins, one of the seven deadly sins is, according to them, envy. Well, according to the Bible, it actually is a deadly sin. It is also often a secret sin. You may be the most envious person on earth, and I wouldn't even know it. I might be the most envious person in the world, and you might not know it. Because the thing is nobody shows their envy. It happens on the inside of us. And that's what makes it so dangerous. Jesus said in Mark 7:20, what comes out of a person is what defiles them. Any guess as to why Jesus said this and to whom? To people who were arguing about ritual cleansing. I mean, it may have been the same guy. The same guy may have gone, well, I talked to John the Baptist, I'm going to go talk to Jesus. Jesus, what do you think about ritual cleansing? And he's like, it doesn't matter. What comes out of a person is what defiles them. For it is from within and out of a person's heart that evil thoughts come. Sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice. Everyone's like, yeah, I agree with that. Deceit, lewdness, envy. Made the list. We were hoping it didn't get on there. Slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside, Jesus says. They're the ones that defile a person. It's not how clean you ritually washed your hand, but it's what's going on the inside. Fishermen understand envy. They go out and they catch a whole big net full of crabs and they put them in these baskets. Do you know they don't have to put lids on there? Because when the crabs, they know this, start to crawl out of the side, another crab reaches up, pulls them down. Interesting. There's an old story, a Greek legend, about a guy that was an athlete, a runner. It was his dream to finish first in the race, to become immortalized in Greek culture and lore. The day came for the big race, and he took off, and he was in front all the way to the very end, and another guy beat him at the very end, edged him out at the very end of the race. The race I should have won, he thought to himself. And then later, he was really unhappy when the city decided to build a marble statue of the guy that actually won. He said, I was supposed to get that. He was so envious that at night he would secretly go and with a chisel in his hand and a hammer, he would chisel away at the base of that marble statue. Could you just see that guy out there? Like, I'm going to get you back. I'm going to destroy your marble statue. One night, went a little too far. Hit it a little too hard. Chiseled away a little too much. And part of the structure collapsed. Massive marble statue fell over on him and crushed him. The writer says he died beneath the weight of the marble replica of the man he had grown to hate. His own envy had destroyed him. The book of Job says envy slays the simple. The simple. The man we meet in this story, the certain Jew, who didn't know the answer to life's most important question because he never asked it. Simple. Have you asked that question? The answer is this. If you know Jesus, you know life. And if you don't, you don't know life.